Hello, and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a feature article by Baker et al. Evolution and Impact of a Diagnostic Point-of-Care Ultrasound Program in a PICU. Objectives: to evaluate the impact of point-of-care ultrasound or POCUS use on clinicians within a PICU and to assess infrastructural elements of our POCUS program development. Design: retrospective observational study. Setting: large academic non-cardiac PICU in the United States. Subjects: patients in a PICU who had diagnostic POCUS performed. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: between January 1, 2017 and December 31, 2022, 7,201 diagnostic POCUS studies were ordered. 1,930, or 26.8%, had a quality assurance or QA record generated in an independent POCUS QA database. The cardiac domain was most frequently imaged, with 81% of ordered studies and 81.2% of reviewed studies. POCUS images changed clinician understanding of pathophysiology in 563 of 1,930 cases, or 29.2%. When this occurred, management was changed in 318 of 563 cases, or 56.5%. Cardiac POCUS studies altered clinician suspected pathophysiology in 30.1% of cases, or 472 of 1,568, compared with 21.5%, or 91 of 362 in non-cardiac studies, with a p-value equal to 0.06. Among cases where POCUS changed clinician understanding, management changed more often following cardiac than non-cardiac POCUS, with a p-value equal to 0.02. Clinicians identified a need for cardiology consultation or complete echocardiograms in 294 of 1,568 cardiac POCUS studies, or 18.8%. Orders for POCUS imaging increased by 94.9%, and revenue increased by 159.4% from initial to final study year. QA database use by both clinicians and reviewers decreased annually as QA processes evolved in the setting of technologic growth and unit expansion. Conclusions: diagnostic POCUS imaging in the PICU frequently yields information that alters diagnosis and changes management. As PICU POCUS use increased, QA processes evolved, resulting in decreased use of our initial QA database. Modifications to QA processes are likely necessary as clinical contexts change over time. Abstract 2 is a feature article by Linz et al. Evaluation of a comprehensive algorithm for PICU patients with new fever or instability. Association of clinical decision support with testing practices. Objectives: previously, we implemented a comprehensive decision support tool, a new fever algorithm, to support the evaluation of PICU patients with new fever or instability. This tool was associated with a decline in culture rates without safety concerns. We assessed the impact of the algorithm on testing practices by identifying the proportion of cultures pre versus post implementation that were discordant with algorithm guidance and may have been avoidable. Design: retrospective evaluation 12 months pre versus post quality improvement intervention. Setting: single center academic PICU and pediatric cardiac ICU. Subjects: all admitted patients. Interventions: implementing the new fever algorithm in July 2020. Measurements and main results: patient medical records were reviewed to categorize indications for all blood, respiratory, and urine cultures. Among cultures obtained for new fever or new clinical instability, we assessed specific testing patterns that were discordant from the algorithm's guidance, such as blood cultures obtained without documented concern for sepsis, without initiation of antibiotics, respiratory cultures without respiratory symptoms, urine cultures without a urinalysis or pyuria, and pan cultures, including concurrent blood, respiratory, and urine cultures. Among 2,827 cultures, 1,950, or 69%, were obtained for new fever or instability. The proportion of peripheral blood cultures obtained without clinical concern for sepsis declined from 18.6% to 10.4%, with a p-value less than 0.0007. Respiratory cultures without respiratory symptoms declined from 41.5% to 27.4%, with a p-value equal to 0.01. Urine cultures without a urinalysis did not decline, from 27.6% to 25.1%. Urine cultures without pyuria declined from 83% to 73.7%, with a p-value equal to 0.04. Pan cultures declined from 22.4% to 10.6%, with a p-value less than 0.0001. Overall, algorithm discordant testing declined from 39% to 30%, with a p-value less than 0.0001. Conclusions. The majority of cultures obtained were for new fever or instability, and introduction of the new fever algorithm was associated with reductions in algorithm discordant testing practices and pan cultures. There remain opportunities for improvement, and additional strategies are warranted to optimize testing practices in this complex patient population. Abstract 3 is a feature article by Stansky et al. Diagnostic validation of the updated pediatric sepsis biomarker risk 2 for acute kidney injury prediction model in pediatric septic shock. Objectives. We previously derived the updated pediatric sepsis biomarker risk for acute kidney injury or PERSEVERE 2 AKI prediction model, which had robust diagnostic test characteristics for severe AKI on day 3 of septic shock. We now sought to validate this model in an independent cohort of children to the one in which the model was developed. Design. A secondary analysis of a multicenter prospective observational study carried out from January 2019 to December 2022. Setting. 10 PICUs in the United States. Patients included children with septic shock 1 week to 18 years old admitted to the PICU. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. 79 of 363 patients, or 22%, had severe AKI on day 3 of septic shock, defined as kidney disease improving global outcome stage 2 or higher. Patients were assigned a probability of severe AKI on day 3 of septic shock using the PERSEVERE 2 AKI model. The model predicted day 3 severe AKI with an area under the receiver operating characteristic curve of 0.89 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.85 to 0.93, sensitivity of 77% with a 95% confidence interval of 66 to 86%, specificity of 88% with a 95% confidence interval of 84 to 92%, positive predictive value of 65% with a 95% confidence interval of 54 to 74%, and negative predictive value of 93% with a 95% confidence interval of 89 to 96%. These data represent an increase in post-test probability of day 3 severe AKI with a positive test from 22% to 65% and a prevalence threshold of 28%. On multivariable regression, the PERSEVERE 2 AKI prediction model demonstrated greater adjusted odds ratio for day 3 severe AKI, with an adjusted odds ratio of 11.2 and a 95% confidence interval of 4.9 to 25.3, and lesser adjusted odds ratio for failure of day 3 renal recovery from early AKI, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.31 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.13 to 0.69. Conclusions. The PERSEVERE 2 AKI model demonstrates consistently robust performance for prediction of new or persistent day 3 severe AKI in children with septic shock. A major limitation is that actual day 3 severe AKI prevalence is below the prevalence threshold for the test, and thus future work should focus on evaluating use in enriched populations. Abstract 4 is a feature article by Kai et al. Comprehensive characterization of surface-bound proteins and measurement of fibrin-fiber thickness on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation circuits collected from patients. Objectives. To characterize surface-bound proteins and to measure the thickness of fibrin fibers bound to extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO circuits used in children. Design. Single-center observational prospective study, April to November 2021. Setting. PICU at Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, Australia. Patients included patients aged less than 18 years on veno-arterial ECMO and without pre-existing disorder. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. ECMO circuits were collected from 6 patients. Circuit samples were collected from 5 different sites and subsequently processed for proteomic and scanning electronic microscopy studies. The concentration of proteins bound to ECMO circuit samples was measured using a bicinconinic acid protein assay, whereas characterization of the bound proteome was performed using data-independent acquisition mass spectrometry. The Reactome Overrepresentation Pathway Analyses tool was used to identify functional pathways related to bound proteins. For the scanning electron microscopy studies, ECMO circuit samples were prepared and imaged, and the thickness of bound fibrin fibers was measured using the Fiji ImageJ software version 1.53C. Protein binding to ECMO circuit samples and fibrin networks showed significant intra-circuit and inter-patient variation. The median total protein concentration was 19 micrograms per milliliter, with a range of 0 to 76.9 micrograms per milliliter, and the median total number of proteins was 2,011, with a range of 1,435 to 2,777. A total of 933 proteins were commonly bound to ECMO circuit samples from all patients and were functionally involved in 212 pathways, with signal transduction, cell cycle, and metabolism of proteins being the top three pathway categories. The median intracircuit fibrin fiber thickness was 0.2 micrometers, with a range of 0.15 to 0.24 micrometers, whereas the median interpatient fibrin fiber thickness was 0.18 micrometers, with a range of 0.15 to 0.21 micrometers. Conclusions. In this report, we have characterized proteins and fibrin thickness bound to ECMO circuits in six children. The techniques and approaches may be useful for investigating interactions between blood, coagulation, and the ECMO circuit, and have the potential for circuit design. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation by Maurer et al. Pediatric hematology and oncology patients on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outcomes in a multicenter retrospective cohort from 2009 to 2021. Objective: to describe characteristics associated with survival for pediatric patients with an oncologic diagnosis or hematopoietic cell transplant supported with extracorporeal membrane oxygenation or ECMO. Design: multicenter retrospective study. Setting: 16 PICUs in the United States and Israel. Patients: we included patients aged younger than 19 years with an oncologic diagnosis or hematopoietic cell transplant who required ECMO support between 2009 and 2021. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. A total of 149 patients were included in the study cohort. There were 118 patients with an oncologic diagnosis and 31 that received hematopoietic cell transplant. The indications for ECMO were respiratory failure in 46%, combined respiratory and cardiac failure in 28%, and cardiac failure in 25%. Venovenous or VV ECMO was used in 45% of patients, with 53% of patients being placed on venoarterial or VA ECMO. For the oncologic group, survival to ECMO decannulation was 52% or 62 of 118. For the hematopoietic cell transplant group, survival to ECMO decannulation was 64% or 20 of 31. For the oncologic group, survival to hospital discharge was 36% or 43 of 118, and for the hematopoietic cell transplant group, survival to hospital discharge was 42% or 13 of 31. After adjusting for other factors, requiring cardiopulmonary resuscitation was associated with greater odds ratio of mortality, with an odds ratio of 3 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.2 to 7.7. Conclusions. Survival to ECMO decannulation of pediatric oncologic and hematopoietic cell transplant patients in this study was 52 to 64%, depending upon diagnosis. However, survival to hospital discharge remains poor. Future research should prioritize understanding factors contributing to the survival gap within these patient populations. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation by Ming Wang et al. Severe pneumonia in PICU admissions. The Pediatric Acute and Critical Care Medicine Asian Network, or PACMAN, observational cohort study from 2020 to 2022. Objectives: mortality from pneumonia is 3 times higher in Asia compared with industrialized countries. We aim to determine the epidemiology, microbiology, and outcome of severe pneumonia in PICUs across the Pediatric Acute and Critical Care Medicine Asian Network, or PACMAN. Design: prospective multicenter observational study from June 2020 to September 2022. Setting: 15 PICUs in PACMAN. Patients: all children younger than 18 years old diagnosed with pneumonia and admitted to the PICU. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Clinical, microbiologic, and outcome data were recorded. The primary outcome was PICU mortality. univariate and multivariable logistic regression was performed to investigate associations between PICU mortality and explanatory risk factors on presentation to the PICU. Among patients screened, 846 of 11,778 PICU patients, or 7.2%, had pneumonia, with a median age of 1.2 years and an interquartile range of 0.4 to 3.7 years. Respiratory syncytial virus was detected in 111 of 846 cases, or 13.1%. The most common bacteria were Staphylococcus species in 71 of 846, or 8.4%, followed by Pseudomonas species in 60 of 846, or 7.1%. Second-generation cephalosporins were the most common broad-spectrum antibiotics prescribed in 322 of 846, or 38.1%, followed by carbapenems in 174 of 846, or 20.6%. Invasive mechanical ventilation was provided in 438 of 846, or 51.8%, and non-invasive respiratory support was provided in 500 of 846, or 59.1%. PICU mortality was 65 of 846, or 7.7%. In the multivariable logistic regression model, age, pediatric index of mortality 3 score, and drowsiness were associated with greater odds of mortality. Adjusted odds ratio for age was 1.08 with a 95% confidence interval of 1 to 1.6. Adjusted odds ratio of pediatric index of mortality 3 score was 1.03 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 1.05. And adjusted odds ratio of drowsiness was 2.73 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.24 to 6. Conclusions. In the Pac-Man contributing PICUs, pneumonia is a frequent cause for admission in 7% and is associated with a greater odds of mortality. Abstract 7 is a PCCM Notes, Methods, and Statistics article by Huxford et al. The 2024 Pediatric Sepsis Challenge, Predicting In-Hospital Mortality in Children with Suspected Sepsis in Uganda. Abstract. The aim of this technical note is to inform the pediatric critical care data research community about the 2024 Pediatric Sepsis Data Challenge. This competition aims to facilitate the development of open-source algorithms to predict in-hospital mortality in Ugandan children with sepsis. The challenge is to first develop an algorithm using a synthetic training dataset, which will then be scored according to standard diagnostic testing criteria and then be evaluated against a non-synthetic test dataset. The datasets originate from admissions to 6 hospitals in Uganda from 2017 to 2020 and include 3,837 children 6 to 60 months old who were confirmed or suspected to have a diagnosis of sepsis. The synthetic dataset was created from a random subset of the original data. The test validation dataset closely resembles the synthetic dataset. The challenge should generate an optimal model for predicting in-hospital mortality. Following external validation, this model could be used to improve the outcomes for children with proven or suspected sepsis in low and middle income settings. Abstract 8 is a PCCM trial by Curley et al. The nurse implemented chronotherapeutic bundle in critically ill children. Restore Resilience, or R-squared, pilot testing in a two-phase cohort study from 2017 to 2021. Objectives. Pilot test the nurse-led chronotherapeutic bundle in critically ill children, Restore Resilience, or R-squared. Design. A two-phase cohort study was carried out from 2017 to 2021. Setting. Two similarly sized and organized PICUs in the United States. Patients. Children 6 months to 17 years old who were mechanically ventilated for acute respiratory failure. Interventions. R-squared 7-item chronotherapeutic bundle, including 1. Replication of child's pre-hospital daily routine, id-est sleep or wake, feeding, and activity patterns. 2. Cycle day and night light and sound modulation. 3. Minimal effective sedation. 4. Night fasting with bolus enteral daytime feedings. 5. Early progressive mobility. 6. Nursing care continuity. And 7. Parent diaries. Measurements and main results. Children underwent environmental and patient monitoring. Environmental monitoring included light and sound, and patient monitoring included actigraphy, activity log, salivary melatonin, and electroencephalogram. Parents completed the child's daily routine and sleep survey and family-centered care scale. the primary outcome was post-extubation daytime activity consolidation, defined as daytime activity ratio estimate. 20 baseline phase and 36 intervention phase participants were enrolled. The baseline phase was from 2017 to 2019, and the intervention phase was from 2019 to 2021. During the intervention phase, nurses used the child's daily routine and sleep survey to construct children's PICU schedules. Overall compliance with the nurse-implemented R-squared elements 1 to 5 increased from 18% with an interquartile range of 13 to 30% at baseline to 63% with an interquartile range of 53 to 68% during the intervention phase, with a p-value less than 0.001. Intervention participants were exposed to their pre-hospital daily routine with a p-value equal to 0.002, cycled day-night light and sound modulation with a p-value less than 0.001, and early progressive mobility on more PICU days with a p-value equal to 0.02. Sedation target identification, enteral feeding schedules, and nursing care continuity did not differ between phases. Parent diaries were seldom used. Daytime activity ratio estimate improved during the intervention phase and was higher pre-extubation, with a median of 62% versus 53% and a p-value equal to 0.04, but not post-extubation, 62% versus 57% with a p-value equal to 0.56. Conclusions. In the PICU, implementation of an individualized nurse-implemented chronotherapeutic bundle is feasible. Children who received the R-squared bundle had increased pre-extubation daytime activity consolidation compared to children receiving usual care. Given variation in protocol adherence, further R-squared testing should include interprofessional collaboration, pragmatic trial design, and implementation science strategies. Abstract 9 is an online special article by Sans Wu et al. Fluid Management in Critically Ill Children: Single-Center Retrospective Comparison of Trauma and Postoperative Patients from 2020 to 2022. Objective: injury and surgery both represent well-defined starting points of a predictable inflammatory response, but the consequent response to IV fluids has not been studied. We aim to review and compare our single-center fluid management strategies in these two populations. Design: retrospective cohort study from January 2020 to July 2022. The primary outcome was total IV fluid administered. Net fluid balances and select clinical outcomes were also evaluated. Setting: single tertiary academic center and level 1 pediatric trauma center in New York. Patients: a data set of critically ill trauma and surgical patients aged 0 to 18 years who were admitted to the PICU from 2020 to 2022. Trauma patients had at least moderate traumatic injuries with an injury severity score of greater than or equal to 9, and surgical patients had at least a 1-hour operation time. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We identified 25 trauma and 115 surgical patients. During the first 5 days of hospitalization, we did not identify an association between grouping and total IV fluids administered and fluid balance in the pre-hospital, emergency department, and operating room, with p-values equal to 0.9 and 0.79, even when adjusted for weight, with a p-value equal to 0.96. Time trend graphs of net fluid balance and IV fluid administered illustrated analogous fluid requirement and response with the transition from net positive to net negative fluid balance between 48 and 72 hours. There was an association between total IV fluid and ventilator requirement, with a p-value equal to 0.003. Conclusions. Critically ill pediatric trauma and postoperative patients seem to have similar fluid management and balance after injury or surgery. In our opinion, these two critically ill populations could be combined in large prospective studies on optimal fluid therapy in critically ill children. Abstract 10 is an online cardiac intensive care article by Jen Hung Wu et al. Airway Anomalies in Pediatric Patients After Surgery for Congenital Heart Disease, Single-Center Retrospective Cohort Study in Taiwan from 2017 to 2020. Objectives: airway anomalies increase risk of morbidity and mortality in postoperative pediatric patients with congenital heart disease. We aim to identify airway anomalies and the association with intermediate outcomes in patients undergoing surgery for congenital heart disease. Design: single-center hospital-based retrospective study in Taiwan from 2017 to 2020. Setting: a tertiary referral hospital in Taiwan. Patients: all pediatric patients who underwent surgery for congenital heart disease and were admitted to the PICU and had data about airway evaluation by cardiopulmonary CT scan or bronchoscopy. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Among 820 congenital heart disease patients identified as having undergone airway evaluation in the PICU, 185, or 22.6%, were diagnosed with airway anomalies, including structural lesions in 146 of 185, or 78.9%, and dynamic problems were seen in 87 of 185, or 47%. In this population, the explanatory factors associated with greater odds of airway anomaly were premature birth, genetic syndromes, and in those with preoperative ventilator use. Odds ratio for premature birth was 1.9 with a p-value equal to 0.002. Odds ratio for genetic syndromes was 2.6 with a p-value less than 0.001. And odds ratio for preoperative ventilator use was 4.28 with a p-value less than 0.001. In comparison to those without airway anomalies, the presence of airway anomalies was associated with higher hospital mortality, prolonged intubation days, longer PICU length of stay, and greater hazard of intermediate mortality. For the presence of airway anomalies versus those without airway anomalies, hospital mortality was 11.4% versus 2.7%, with a p-value less than 0.001. Presence of airway anomalies also had prolonged length of intubation, 8 days with a range of 1 to 27 days, versus 1 day in those without airway anomalies with a range of 1 to 5 days and a p-value less than 0.001. Presence of airway anomalies was also associated with longer PICU length of stay, 23 days with a range of 8 to 81 days, versus 7 days in those without airway anomalies with a range of 4 to 18 days and a p-value less than 0.001. And the adjusted hazard ratio for those with airway anomalies was 2.6, with a p-value equal to 0.001. Conclusions. In our single-center retrospective study from 2017 to 2020, between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 of our postoperative congenital heart disease patients undergoing an airway evaluation had airway anomalies. Factors associated with greater odds of airway anomaly included those with premature birth or genetic syndromes and preoperative ventilator use. Overall, in patients undergoing airway evaluation, the finding of an airway anomaly was associated with longer postoperative intubation duration and greater hazard of intermediate mortality. There is an online research letter this month by Weber et al. Effects of ethanol locks on burst pressure for small caliber non-power injectable peripherally inserted central catheters. To the editor, in our previous work in which patients were consented for the use of ethanol lock therapy for catheter salvage, we found the practice to be safe and effective in a wide range of polyurethane catheters in the PICU. Within that series, we identified that 2 of 8 small caliber 2.6 French non-power injectable peripherally inserted central catheters, or PICs, failed prematurely after ethanol exposure. It was unclear if the PIC failure was related to ethanol exposure or other factors. Ethanol exposure testing has not been performed by the manufacturer in these catheters and is considered off-label use. In this small bench study, we assessed the burst pressure of 2.6 French PICs following various times of ethanol exposure to determine if ethanol lock therapy contributed to compromise the polyurethane catheter PIC material. Double lumen 2.6 French polyurethane PICs were cut into 5-centimeter long segments. A solution of 95% ethanol was diluted with sterile water for injection to achieve a final concentration of 70% ethanol. Each catheter segment was submerged in either water for 24 hours or 70% ethanol for 0.5, 1, 2, 24, 48, or 84 hours. After each PIC segment was removed from the solution, the larger lumen was cannulated with a 25-gauge blood collection butterfly catheter and secured in place with a zero-silk braided suture. The prepared PIC segment was flushed with saline, then clamped distally with a hemostat. The clamped PIC was then submerged in 5 centimeters of water. To assess the burst pressure of the catheters, an Arduino Uno R3 microcontroller was used to record pressure data from a harsh media pressure sensor in series with the clamped PIC segment. Each PIC segment was manually flushed until burst was achieved. The burst pressure was recorded as the maximum pressure before segment rupture. A minimum of 5 PIC segments were tested under each dwell time. A total of 37 PIC segments were included in the analyses, including 7 segments for the water bath and 5 segments for each of the times bathed in the 70% ethanol solution. The pig segments exposed to water had a median burst pressure of 195 pounds per square inch, or PSI, with an interquartile range of 192 to 215 PSI. There was a decrease in burst pressure within 30 minutes of dwell in the ethanol solution, which persisted through the 84-minute dwell time period. For the Medcom 2.6 French double lumen pigs, which are non-power injectable, immersion in ethanol significantly decreases catheter strength. This was evident in catheter segments exposed to 70% ethanol for times as short as 30 minutes. Ethanol locks exhibit favorable outcomes when used for central line-associated bloodstream infection or CLABSI prevention and catheter salvage therapy in active CLABSIs. Recent data suggests that larger 4 and 5 French polyurethane catheters, specifically those developed for power injection, exposed to ethanol demonstrate no appreciable change to their integrity. The use of ethanol has been increasingly used in polyurethane catheters in the clinical setting in response to this promising data, although few studies assess smaller polyurethane catheters frequently used in pediatric populations. Even though ethanol locks play a crucial role in CLABSI prevention and catheter salvage therapies, the use of ethanol lock therapy in Medcomp 2.6 French non-power injectable PICCs may be inadvisable, as even 30 minutes of exposure led to a significant drop in burst pressure. There may be an overestimation of this effect due to submersion of our catheter samples in ethanol as opposed to intraluminal ethanol instillation, and burst pressures all remained above manufacturer recommendations for infusions or bolus injections regardless of ethanol exposure time, with the range being 14.5 to 17.4 PSI. Despite these limitations and considerations, we find the results important to report. Further testing is required to assess whether ethanol lock therapy exposure results in reduced burst pressure in both smaller size, meaning 1.9 French non-power injectable polyurethane catheters, as well as larger power injectable PICCs, all of which are used in the care of pediatric patients. While polyurethane catheters of all sizes may display reduced burst pressure following exposure to ethanol, our prior study suggests that the smallest catheters may be most vulnerable to clinically relevant failure. The PCCM narrative this month is by Cecilia Gallego Suarez, The Power of Goodbyes. A year ago, I lost my cousin to gun violence. His death was tragic and unfair. His life was stolen. He, who was like an older brother to me, was suddenly gone, and I didn't get to say goodbye. For over a year, I have silently carried my unsaid goodbye while working as a pediatric critical care medicine fellow caring for critically ill children, adolescents, and their families during their most vulnerable times. My job is to stabilize, provide supportive or therapeutic care, and restore the health of each patient to the best of my ability. Our team works endlessly and selflessly to give our best to each patient. Our hearts and minds come together to work as one. Survival is the first outcome in our minds. We face the morbidity associated with critical illness. Long hours, days, or months with endless monitoring, we navigate the unknowns, adjust our management. We fight for them and with them. We hope and watch carefully for signs of recovery. Most of our patients will recover, but some won't. Some illnesses and injuries are non-survivable and surpass our best efforts and interventions. And even though mortality in pediatric critical illness has declined significantly over the last two decades, death and suffering are sometimes part of the job, as they are a part of life. Over the past year, I have reflected on the uncertainty and fragility of life. I have thought of the lost battles and last breaths in this PICU, the pain and loneliness in a grieving parent or sibling following the loss of a child to firearm-related injury, drowning, cancer, polytrauma, or chronic illness, the young couple who lost their newborn to sepsis or congenital heart disease, all the unexpected and early goodbyes. I used to feel defeated and helpless in the face of these farewells. They were a painful reminder of how we failed to save a child, failed to help a family. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know if there was anything that could be said. But grief changed me. I see life and death differently now. And even though I work tirelessly every day to save each patient that comes through our doors, I now recognize the value of providing palliative care and honoring life when it is coming to an end. Although always painful, unexpected, and too soon, I understand the value of having the chance to say goodbye. These moments are the hardest. They're full of difficult conversations and heartbreak. No child or teenager is supposed to die. No family should lose someone who has barely lived, but what an honor and privilege it is to walk the end-of-life pathway beside them. An honor that requires more humanity than medical knowledge, a privilege that demands honesty, patience, tenderness, and kindness. I have learned that there are infinite ways to say goodbye. For some, it is watching the sunset or a movie, singing a song, holding their baby, being alone, or being together one last time. Goodbyes can be filled with silence, tears, or words. Others with human touch. Regardless of the space, time, or form, having had the opportunity to say goodbye might make things better when they cannot be made right. A final farewell can become a memory to celebrate life. I have seen the power of goodbyes. I have regretted my missed chance. Therefore, in memory of my cousin's life, from now on I will try to find the right words and do everything in my power to protect a family's final wishes and time together, and never forget to say goodbye. This concludes the abstracts for the November 2024 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.